This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hours after suggesting a possible delay in the 2020 U.S. presidential election, U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday said he did not want to postpone the vote, but remained concerned that millions of mail-in ballots would cause problems. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Trump told reporters that he does not want the election delayed, but he also does not want one, in his words, that does not mean anything. Mr. Trump cited recent media reports about potential problems with mail-in ballots arriving late and said it could take weeks, months, or even years to sort out any problems. The president does not have the authority to change the election date. That power resides with the U.S. Congress. The Constitution makes no provision for moving the inauguration beyond January of 2021. More than 1,000 people gathered outside a historic Atlanta church to pay their last respects to longtime U.S. Representative John Lewis, as former presidents praised the civil rights pioneer at his funeral Thursday. Former presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton both spoke of Lewis's humble beginnings on a farm in Troy, Alabama, to become a leader of the Black civil rights movement and ultimately the man known as the conscience of Congress. Former President Barack Obama said in his eulogy that Lewis's record of championing the civil rights must continue. In Obama's words, he knew that nonviolent protest is patriotic, a way to raise public awareness, put a spotlight on injustice, and make the powers that be uncomfortable. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Taiwan's former president, Lee Teng-hui, who brought direct elections and other democratic changes to the self-governed island despite fierce saber-rattling by China, died Thursday, according to local media reports. He was 97. Lee strove to create a separate non-Chinese identity for Taiwan, angering not only China, which considers the island part of its territory, but also members of his Nationalist Party, who hoped to return victorious to the mainland. Lee later openly moved forward with other provisions. And the annual meeting of world leaders of the United Nations is going virtual this year for the first time in its 75-year history because of the COVID-19 pandemic, except for the likely personal appearance by U.S. President Donald Trump. The U.S. Ambassador Kelly Craft said Thursday that we're hoping that President Trump will actually be speaking in person in the General Assembly. In past years, thousands of people have flocked to New York in September for the annual meeting of the world leaders at the General Assembly, known as the General Debate. Because of COVID-19, General Assembly members agreed this month to have each country's leader deliver a pre-recorded speech. Records show that a Chinese scientist charged with visa fraud after U.S. authorities said she concealed her military ties was arrested after she left the Chinese consulate in San Francisco to seek medical care. A filing Wednesday by her attorney says Wong Tang had been living in the consulate since June when FBI seized her passport and visa. Tang, who has asthma, was informed last week there was a warrant for her arrest. She had a medical emergency and federal agents arrested her after she visited a doctor. Her attorney is arguing she should be released on bail. The White House and some of its Republican allies in the U.S. Senate are signaling they want to extend, at least temporarily, a $600 per week expanded jobless benefit that has helped keep families and the economy afloat during the COVID-19 pandemic. The move looks to be a little too late to prevent the lapse of the benefit officially on Friday. Democrats have so far rejected an extension and say the next relief bill needs to move as a complete package. Before President Trump spoke, top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell adjourned the chamber for the weekend. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Friday, July 31st. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for James Butte. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. Anti-government protests are planned for today in Zimbabwe.
We support their constitutional right to embark in a peaceful constitutional protest against the regime.
That was Zimbabwe's MDC Alliance Opposition Party Vice President, Tendai Biti. Kenya arrests a wildlife and drug smuggling kingpin. Fistfights, tear gas, and guns in Nairobi's city government. Sudanese Muslims celebrate the Eid al-Adha festival amid COVID-19. And local officials in Nigeria struggle to trace people exposed to the coronavirus.
The first time was about 7. Second was about 14. In the conclusion, when that test was done, I think it was about 70-something.
That was Danjuma Dogo, a community leader in Nigeria, speaking about the rise in COVID-19 cases. All those stories, plus Samson Omale's sports and a tribute to a giant of African music, are next on Daybreak Africa. Our top story is in Zimbabwe, where opposition members and activists have plans to hold nationwide protests today against what they say is widespread government corruption. The ruling party and government appear to be shaken by the expected demonstrations. Late Thursday night, police arrested activists accused of organizing the protests. According to reports, if the activists were not present at their homes, police seized family members instead. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe's president has referred to protest organizers as terrorists, while the Ministry of Home Affairs has labeled the planned marches as unconstitutional. Journalist Kudzai Zvinovashe reports.
Security has been tightened in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Checkpoints into the central business district are stricter, turning back almost everyone who does not work in essential services. On Wednesday, President Emmerson Mnangagwa gave a stern warning to protest organizers.
I want to warn the organizers of this ill-fated demonstration that our security services will be vigilant and on high alert to appropriately respond to their shenanigans.
Journalist Hopo Chingono's bail hearing has been further postponed to Monday. He was arrested last week for allegedly using his social media following to incite people to protest on the 31st. Jacob Ngarivume, leader of Transform Zimbabwe political party, was arrested on similar charges. He is the face of the 31 July protests after calling for Zimbabweans to come out to protest against what he called rampant corruption in the country. Minister of Home Affairs, Kazembe Kazembe, however, links the planned protests to the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, or MDC Alliance.
31 July is a planned insurrection and a naked, illegal, and unconstitutional attempt to seize power. It is about the MDC Alliance attempting to seize power. It is about the MDC Alliance attempting to violently overturn the people's verdict of 31 July 2018.
Earlier this week, the police issued a list of political activists and union leaders they want to interview in connection with the planned protests. Those on the list have gone into hiding. There are reports that police have raided their homes. Despite the government's accusations, the MDC Alliance has not taken ownership of the protests, but has pledged support. MDC Alliance Vice President Tendai Biti spoke to the media this week.
31 July 2020, we support the right of the citizens who have organized 31 July 2020. We support their constitutional right to embark in a peaceful constitutional protest against the regime codified in Section 59 of the Constitution.
While there is significant support for the protest on social media, it's not clear how many will turn out. Various government departments and the ruling ZANU-PF have issued numerous threats to would-be protesters. Government critics say That reveals how alarmed they are. But many Zimbabweans are worried, given that in the past few years, government forces have injured and killed people taking part in earlier protests. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
Conservationists are lauding the arrest in Kenya of alleged wildlife trafficker Abubakar Mansour Mohammed Sarur, who is also wanted in the United States. Sarur is accused of trafficking ivory and rhino horn, as well as conspiracy to launder money and distribute heroin. Experts say the East Africa region has become a hub for the illegal trade, as Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
With the help of U.S. officials, Kenyan authorities arrested Wednesday the alleged wildlife trafficker in the coastal city of Mombasa. Philip Murudhi is a vice president of Species Conservation and Science at the Africa Wildlife Foundation, and he welcomed the arrest of Sarur.
By catching a kingpin, you can actually disrupt the illegal wildlife trade. So it's a dangerous individual who has funding and who is involved in multiple illegalities, and those are the people, the kingpins that you really want to catch. One of the weaknesses of fighting the illegal wildlife trade is that we don't get to the kingpin. A lot of the arrests are of the smaller guys.
Sarur is charged with conspiracy to traffic 190 kilograms of rhino horns and 10 tons of ivory worth more than $7 million. The Kenyan national also is accused of money laundering and distribution of heroin. Investigators believe Sarur is a member of the Koroma Network, a smuggling organization that trades in drug and illegal wildlife products. The network shipped its goods out of ports in Pemba, Mozambique, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Mombasa. Last year, authorities in Uganda arrested the head of the network, Liberian national Moazo Kroma. In 2017, Kenyan police arrested two other key figures, brothers Ibrahim Akasha and Baktash Akasha. The brothers were extradited to the U.S., where they are now serving long-term jail sentences. Alastair Nelson works with the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, a network of 500 experts in the field of human rights, democracy, governance, and development issues. Speaking Wednesday at an online discussion, Nelson said such high-profile arrests have been made possible by authorities from different countries working together.
One of the reasons that we saw this law enforcement success is that we had long-term investigations by groups that were mandated to work across different countries and work with different local law enforcement authorities. So that was the USDA with the Akashas, it was US Fish and Wildlife with the Kroma case, and the China Anti-Smuggling Bureau. And they used traditional long-term investigation methods. So they used a lot of human intelligence. They got close to the organized crime groups. But key is that they had to work very, very closely in partnership with trusted national law enforcement authorities.
Corruption and political connections often are blamed for the failure of some African countries to arrest and prosecute high-level figures in the illegal drug and wildlife trades. Now, the global effort to save Africa's wild animals is yielding fruit. The Africa Wildlife Foundation shows elephant and rhino populations are on the rise in some parts of the continent. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Staying in Kenya, the Ministry of the Interior has ordered the Inspector General of Police to disarm members of the Nairobi County government following a string of physical fights between lawmakers, some of whom are licensed gun owners. Journalist Maureen Ojiambo has more from Nairobi.
Chaos has engulfed Nairobi's county government in recent days. City lawmakers have thrown both punches and chairs during the heated debates over a motion to oust the Speaker of the county's legislature. On Wednesday, Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i ordered the disarmament of Nairobi County lawmakers, some of whom carry guns. Though no one has fired their weapons in the assembly, Matiang'i says that in the heated debates, armed lawmakers may harm each other.
And I've asked the Inspector General of Police today with the regional security team in Nairobi to disarm everyone around that county assembly, anyone who holds firearms, those that there could be people. We already collected 14 guns. I suspect there could probably be more firearms. And let them tell the Firearm Licensing and Control Board to cancel all the licenses. We withdraw those firearms from them.
Police officers stormed the Nairobi County Assembly earlier this week to restore order. Matiang'i says a large number of security forces in Nairobi's central business district are deployed around the county assembly premises due to chaos.
Our security deployment around the CBD in Nairobi, 25 to 30% of it is around the County Assembly of Nairobi. And most of that is because of what happens around there is just pure criminality. And we cannot go on this way. There are decisions that need to be made.
But some lawmakers in Kenya's capital say police are to blame for violence too. Earlier this week, a video emerged showing officers assaulting Nairobi lawmaker Patricia Mudheu on the county assembly premises after a chaotic session. Speaking after the incident, Ms. Mudheu said that she was feeling unwell when the police gained entry and dispersed them.
Police actually gained entry. As I was seated in our lounge, there was some tear gas and people came running towards my side. And since I couldn't run because I'm unwell, I just decided to sit. Immediately, police approached and, you know, they were telling us to get out. But to my shock, one police hit me. I have some marks and he couldn't stop. There were four of them. And despite me, like, lying down, they didn't stop. They continued beating me. I was unarmed in my place of work.
The Federation for Women Lawyers in Kenya has called for action to be taken on police officers that were captured on camera brutalizing Mudheu. Nancy Kilu, the Federation chairperson, said that there are increased cases of use of excessive force by police on unarmed civilians.
What we witnessed were actions against women who are carrying out lawful duties at their place of work. This cannot go unaccounted for. We shall therefore be commencing specific legal procedures to ensure that we safeguard women's spaces of work without fear of intimidation.
On Wednesday, Kenya's Director of Criminal Investigation ordered the police accused of assaulting Mudheu to be interdicted after investigations. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Sudanese Muslims are celebrating the Eid al-Adha holiday today, but amid the COVID-19 outbreak, the festivities aren't the same as in other years. Sudanese officials are calling on citizens to continue observing precautionary public health measures to avoid new infections during the celebrations. Journalist Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Hundreds of heads of sheep could be seen along main roads leading in and out of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, Thursday, as family prepared for the Eid of Al-Adha feast. The feast in which Muslim families traditionally slaughter a sheep for a festive family meal marks the end of the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. 43-year-old Umm Muhammad Jabir, her face covered by a traditional cloth, accompanies her husband at one of the livestock markets along Jebel Aulia Road in Khartoum's Kalakla neighborhood. They are looking to buy a sheep for their family of five. Jabir says, this year it is difficult to celebrate Eid with an extended family due to COVID-19 travel restrictions.
Before, we used to go and visit some of our families or we go for outing. But now, we can't do that anymore. My small family members are aware about the ongoing coronavirus and all of us are strictly following the precautionary measures. We avoid all social gatherings by all means, so this time we shall celebrate it alone as the small family.
35-year-old Murtada Khidir is one of the livestock vendors. He wears a brown locally made face mask and says livestock vendors try to follow all health directives to avoid getting infected. Khidir says even though the pandemic has affected their business, they are still happy that families are able to afford to buy sheep.
We maintain social distancing and most of our customers have their sanitizers in their cars, but they will wear face masks, including children, all the time. And thanks God, up to now we have not experienced any positive case among our people here in the market.
Sudanese officials are urging the public to take precautions against COVID-19 during the Eid holiday. Suleiman Mohammadi Bashar is an official at the Sudan's Ministry of Religious Affairs. He has directed imams and their congregations to take precautions during the Eid prayers and celebrations.
All imams should shorten the duration of the prayer by choosing short verses from the Holy Quran. They should also shorten the homily to shortest time possible. All congregations should be wearing masks or use their religious scarf if they can't afford providing masks. all should carry along with them the prayer mat.
On Wednesday, Professor Sadiq Taur, who heads the Sudanese Government Committee Against COVID-19, tells press that 14 of Sudan's 18 states have not recorded new infections in the last 2 weeks. He says that is an encouraging sign and applauded citizens for following health directives. But he urges people to remain vigilant against the disease during the Eid festivity.
The committee therefore urges all to maintain their precautionary measures for the next 3 weeks to ensure that we are safe and to avoid any other new infections of the pandemic. We also here notifying all travelers who might be coming to the country that they should undertake a test from a recognized laboratory through our embassies in the respective countries.
Since February, Sudan has recorded more than 11,000 COVID-19 cases. Over 700 people have died. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
As the number of confirmed COVID-19 infections in Nigeria increases, contact tracing of patients in the country's communities is becoming more difficult for health officials. Nigeria's Presidential Task Force Committee on COVID-19 has criticized some Nigerians who refuse to assist contact tracers due to fear and stigma. But in some communities, local leaders have stepped up to help the tracers do their job. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
Daniel Sila is the town crier in this Mabushi village near Abuja City. Occasionally, he disseminates vital information from the village chief to people who live in the community. But in recent weeks, his message has been about COVID-19 and ways to prevent it. Sila says he also helps health officials with their contact tracing mission in the village.
They come with a helicopter.
Sila says they came in their vehicles. I wore coronavirus protection clothing with them. This community was among the first in the Abuja region to record COVID-19 infections. Danjuma Dogo, the community secretary, says cases have increased exponentially.
First time was about 7, second was about 14. The conclusion, when that test was done, I think it was about 70-something.
Health authorities responded by conducting extensive testing in Mabushi. But as more positive cases were discovered, it became a challenge to trace them. They sought an audience with the community heads, and officials like Danjuma Dogo were assigned to help health workers locate positive cases.
And they came with the list. We give them a quick response by working together with them to fish out those was affected. I was part of the committee because the list was with me. We have to go around and be checking who and who is affected.
So far, Nigeria has recorded more than 41,000 cases of COVID-19, but the fear and stigma attached to the disease have limited the number of people who show up for testing or report symptoms. Last month, the Presidential Task Force Committee on Coronavirus criticized the reluctance of Nigerians to aid health workers or participate in contact tracing. The committee says unless Nigerians change their attitudes, the pandemic cannot be brought under control. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, Jason. We begin the sports with the World Athletics Council approving new dates for the World Under-20 Championships, Nairobi 2020. The World Under-20 Championships will now be held in Nairobi, Kenya from 17th to the 22nd of August 2021, 1 week after the Tokyo Olympic Games. Staying with athletics, World 10,000 meters champion Ugandan Joshua Cheptegei says he is confident he will make it to the season opening Diamond League meet in Monaco. The long distance runner is not happy that COVID-19 inadvertently interrupted one of his most successful seasons.
We are being pushed to the walls when it comes to opportunities, when it comes to racing abroad in Europe, in America, in Asia. So this means that we cannot make the most of our career. My plans earlier on, of course, has been to win the Olympic Games, like a 10K 10K gold, and of course also medal in the 5K. So perhaps, maybe if it all goes well, perhaps next year I can still go back to Tokyo and do what I'm best at doing, and that's winning the gold.
Now to Nigeria, where the country's Minister of Youth and Sports Development, Sunday Dairy, says henceforth the Nigerian Football Federation will deregister football clubs who fail to meet club licensing rules.
What we've had in the past is that several of these clubs have found a way to get licensed and approved to compete without fulfilling this. I think we're entering a new regime of enforcement, and we hope that that will protect the players, because without the players, you know, you can't talk about football and the domestic league.
Finally, renowned lawyer and writer Bestine Khazadi, who made history by becoming the first woman ever to be elected as president of Democratic Republic of Congo Football Giants, AS Vita Club, early this month, has been speaking on her new role. Khazadi told my colleague James Butty that her gender is not a limitation in succeeding in a position dominated by men.
Do you think that being a woman will put more pressure on you to prove yourself? After all, the football world is dominated by men.
I have fought all my life for strong leadership, and my election is a lever. As president, it's a large African club. Confirms that nothing is impossible, and that it does not matter whether one is a woman or a man, when the passion with a goal, courage, and daring to realize a dream, anything is possible. Certainly, my success will serve as a model, a pulse for young girls.
That's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jason, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. We look forward to your next report on Monday. Bala Sidibe, a founding member of the seminal West African music group Orchestra Baobab, has died, the group's record label announced. In the 1970s, Orchestra Baobab was one of Senegal's most famous groups. Their songs, like this one called Dimu War, fused West African music with Latin, especially Cuban music. With musicians from Togo, Guinea, Morocco, Nigeria, and Senegal, the group represented Pan-Africanism. The group's administrator, Thierna Coyote, described Sidibe as the pillar of the group. He told the Senegal press agency that Sidibe was two musicians in one, because he sang and played the timpani drums. Coyote said that the day before his death, Sidibe was rehearsing with the band in Dakar in preparation for Orchestra Baobab's 50th anniversary. The band's record label, World Circuit, said, quote, "Bala was a giant of African music and a great and gentle man," end quote. That's it for this Friday, July 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of managing editor James Butty, producer Nicole Beckford, and the rest of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day. Fekunu ci jeuf jeuf.